What an honor. As many of my friends here know, I'm a little nervous about that, and I've been thinking about this this talk for a while, and there's no greater honor than to be honored by your peers, and I appreciate all the vote of confidence that comes forth from this, I hope I can sort of live up to the accolades that King has provided just moments ago. In giving the Thomas Paine Award, I am going to do something a little different than what has sometimes been done in the past. I'm not going to review a topic specifically as much as I hope to use this bully pulpit to talk a few minutes talking to you, the converted, the people who are interested in STD control and prevention, and reflect on some of my own thoughts in an uninterrupted fashion regarding what we're doing and where we're going, and maybe some thoughts about where we could go in the future. My comments and the topic has been alluded to at least in part several times already in this particular room by Julie Gerberding, by John Douglas, and others regarding the questions of why we're not further in terms of our efforts to control STDs. And so perhaps some of my comments will be repetitious or will build upon theirs. I'm not going to talk about issues of resources. You know, we've talked about resources and we've heard again and again that resources in our community are decreasing for this, but at the same time, I think we also have to think about the expanding spectrum of resources. Let's remember that I think last year there were over $300 million spent to buy HPV vaccine, and those are resources, and those are real, and that perhaps represents not enough, but a start towards investment in terms of what we do with STD control. So I'll talk about my topics in just a moment, but before I do, I have to say, and King was very kind to me, but I would not be here without the help of others. And this is a partial list of those who have helped me through the years. And it is only a partial list, and I will apologize in advance for those who are not here, because there are so many, many people. The University of Washington, Sheila Lucart and Hunter Hansfield sort of welcomed me into the research arena and allowed me to begin my research career with regard to STDs. All of this was done and continued to do under the guise and guidance of King and all of those that he assembled to collaborate with him. And, you know, one thing King didn't do was also take credit for introducing me to my wife, who was his administrative assistant, and therefore my boss, long before anything else happened there. I was then recruited to Johns Hopkins by John Bartlett and had tremendous opportunities. Tom Quinn was a welcome collaborator and helped me to move along. Judy Wasserheit, Ann Rompallo, and John Zintelman, as well as Janet Horn, all tolerated my mistakes and errors and errors in judgment as we moved along and helped me to move forward with my career. And Cindy Reichert really ran my laboratory and made me look awfully good on paper. David Glasser was the director of disease control in the city of Baltimore, and he was the person who really invited me and encouraged me to sort of follow a model which heretofore really didn't exist in a lot of places, trying to exist with a foot in both the field of public health and local health departments, as well as universities and research things. And that's a collaboration that continues to move forward in Baltimore, and it's a model that I think is worth encouraging for anybody who's interested in STD control. As King said, then I went on to Birmingham, and working in Birmingham, I've had the privilege of working with a large number of individuals who have really, again, continued to allow me to work with them, have taught me, have encouraged me, and provided me with much of the incentive to move forward. And then throughout the career, there are others, Julie Schachter, Sevki, Lynn Barkley, who have sort of tolerated me and been there for me to bounce ideas off and so forth and so on. Mimicking or sort of reiterating the words of Tom, however, I wouldn't be here without the patience of my family as well. And my wife, Kathy, my two daughters, Sarah and Jessie, both have really allowed me and tolerated my work habits and my wanderings in terms of the work I do. So I thank all of you and all of them, and I thank all of you for the privilege of being here before you today. So now down to business. The topic of my comments, I struggled with what to say, and I decided on a combined topic. I'd like to talk about, in series, translational research and how it impacts STD control. The issue of health disparities and stigma, which have been discussed a lot at this meeting already, and to view them both as a challenge and as an opportunity. And as an outline of the comments that I'm about to start on, I'm going to start with just sort of very quickly going through a few slides regarding STD rates and reminding all of us what we've been reminded on already, that our rates are flat or increasing, and that's a problem. And then to visit a term which is being used more and more in academic settings and means different things to different people, translational research, which I believe will provide us with opportunities both in terms of developing new tools and also to improve the work that we do. Then after that, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about issues related to STDs, stigma, and health disparities, and then I'm going to finish up with a bit of a wish list for where I would really love to see our field go in the future. These sorts of slides are familiar to everybody in the audience. You all know that the good news is that syphilis rates in the United States are still amongst the lowest that they've ever been. The bad news, of course, is that they are flat, or perhaps even increasing, and that has been the case for, depending on how you count it, at least 5 or 6 years. And these rates are the highest rates of this particular disease amongst any developed nation on Earth. Gonorrhea, once again, the rates are flat. Some groups they may be going up in slightly, some groups they may be going down in slightly, but as a population, once again, flat. And chlamydia, as you've heard already from John Douglas, we just passed 1 million cases of chlamydia in the United States this year. The last time there were 1 million cases of any reportable STD in the United States was 1976, when there were a bit little over 1,100,000 cases of gonorrhea reported. So what comes around goes around, doesn't it? And in thinking about these things and thinking about what we do them, all of you are familiar with this very familiar equation that's guided so much of what we do and is a useful organizing principle for how we do it. This is the Anderson and May reproductive rate equation. And the reason I put it up here is not to talk about the elements, but to remind all of us that what this equation represents is an equilibrium formula, and that any time we make a change, whether that's a change regarding patient infectivity, change regarding sexual partner selection and choice, things that modify the duration of infectivity, what we essentially do is reset that equilibrium. And if we don't continue to emphasize and push forward and tend to increase our efforts steadily, that equilibrium will then lead to plateaus. And then we'll be asking what we can do next. So in terms of what we can do next, I think perhaps some of those opportunities relate to translational research. And translational research is another one of those terms that everybody talks about, and probably if you ask 10 different people, you could get 10 different answers, although there would be certain similarities about them. And I do believe that translational research for those of us in STD and STD control, not STD research, but STD control, provide opportunities for us to move forward. Those opportunities are represented by both new tools and opportunities to improve on exactly what we're doing, improving the clinical services that we offer to our patients. And I'll provide at least one example of that in the next minute or two. Now, it was really a wonderful paper earlier this year in JAMA discussing translational research and what went on. And, you know, when most people talk about translational research, they're talking about the term is often used as bench to bedside. That is, taking basic science or fundamental physiologic observations and moving it forward into new tools for addressing disease. The Institute of Medicine has evaluated this, and within this paper there was a distinction made between T1 and T2 research, and I think that is a useful differentiation. T1 is the bench to bedside research that people have talked about. It represents the transfer of new understandings of disease, that is pathogenesis and pathophysiology, gained in the laboratory into the development of new methods for diagnosis, for treatment, and for prevention, as well as their first testing in human beings. And if we think about the STD field, we have a number of opportunities and a number of new tools that have come to us from the bench that we've taken to the bedside. A partial list of those include nucleic acid amplification tests, the HPV vaccine, type-specific serological tests for herpes infections, key studies showing that suppressive antiviral therapy will prevent herpes transmission to uninfected partners, partner-delivered therapy, circumcision as an approach for HIV prevention. And every one of these efforts, every one of these new tools represents the extension of basic fundamental pathophysiologic, sometimes behavioral research to improve, or at least potentially improve, the care of our patients. And as an example of that, and one that's, I'm sure, familiar to everyone in the audience, there's the issue of nucleic acid amplification tests. Before we had nucleic amplification tests, we were dealing with relatively insensitive tests. Specimen quality was really critical to how well our diagnoses worked, and we had debated as to what was best. Culture was most sensitive, but the non-amplified nucleic acid or antigen detection tests were easier to use and allowed us to take our testing outside the doors of laboratory-based and facilities and research institutions. Nucleic acid amplification tests represented a great increase in terms of the sensitivity of the tests we use, but in my mind, even more important was that they were so much more forgiving in terms of specimen collection and the opportunity to use vaginal swabs that were collected either by clinicians or even more importantly, patients themselves. Or voided urine represented opportunities to really expand what we're doing. And I would submit to you that to use better tests to test the same people that we've tested before is probably a modest increment in terms of what we do. So that the real impact of nucleic acid amplification tests, I believe, and I don't think we've completely resolved them yet, include taking them to non-healthcare settings and to being able and beginning to diagnose individuals who might not seek care. That is, instead of waiting in our clinics for them to come to us, going to them, identifying the people who are at risk, seeking them out, and trying to seek them to provide them with diagnoses and therapy for STDs, which oftentimes they may not be aware they have. There are a number of places that they've been used. These are some of the places I've been fortunate enough to help with. In some instances, school-based clinics, incarcerated individuals. Charlotte Gatos, as Tom mentioned, really has led the forum in terms of diagnosis of military recruits, homeless individuals through street outreach and at shelters, most recently working with Laura Bachman to sort of evaluate the risks of long-haul truck drivers. And I think I'm not sure those are all necessarily the right answers, but I think they're the right sorts of things to be doing with these powerful new tools, to be expanding the horizons and the outreach of the people who we touch. So that I think that when we think about new tools for STD management, we also need to think about what the outcomes of interest are. And I think that that's part of that reframing issue that we heard about this morning. In terms of nucleic acid amplification tests, identifying new cases doesn't help much if patients aren't treated. So that perhaps the metric we need to use is infections treated. Laura Kautsky and her colleagues with regard to the HPV vaccine have already begun to introduce this into issues and the concepts of disease and disease evaluations averted, because it's not only the prevention of cervical cancer, but all of the ancillary clinical and care activities and related to potential diagnosis of HPV-related disease, which benefit from the HPV vaccines. Type-specific tests for herpes and suppressive therapy. Transmissions or new cases averted represent the outcomes of interest. Partner-delivered therapy, again, benefits individuals, not in terms of delivering antibiotics to individuals, but in terms of preventing sequelae and further transmission. And anything we can do to enhance that will enhance our goals of STD prevention. Circumcision, again, the number of foreskins is probably not worth worrying about as much as the issue of the number of HIV infections prevented by lopping off those foreskins. And so we need to refocus not on the procedures, tests, and therapies that we're doing, but the outcomes that we're accomplishing through those use of those tools. And I will comment a little bit more on that in just a few minutes. The other part of translational research, however, is the so-called T2 research. And I think this is really where, for those of us in the room, we have lots of great opportunities. That is, using these new tools, using the results of clinical studies to change clinical practice and healthcare decision making. And I think that's really it, and is one example of what I think is at least presently, perhaps unrealized potential for those observations. I'm going to go back and talk about some of my own research that King mentioned in his introductory comments. In the early 1990s, working with Tom and Charlotte and colleagues at the Baltimore City Health Department and Johns Hopkins, we were very enamored of the new Abbott point of care test, which was available at that time. We thought that perhaps by treating individuals, even though the sensitivity of those tests was somewhat less than the sensitivity of our gold standard test at that time, culture, that we might actually wind up treating more patients. So we did a trial in which we alternated and randomized individuals to either testing with this point of care test or patients who were screened, that is people who did not have other indications for treatment, but were tested for chlamydia otherwise. In this study, I think in many ways the most interesting observations came not from the performance of the point of care test, which unfortunately was not so great, but by two other observations that we've continued to investigate as I've worked in Alabama since leaving Baltimore. One was that in this particular study, 1/4 of patients who had positive screening tests for chlamydia did not get treated within 30 days. As I'll mention in just a moment, that is a proportion of untreated patients which has repeated itself in a number of settings. The other observation we made was that 4% of the individuals who did return for treatment had developed pelvic inflammatory disease in the interval between testing and returning for treatment. We went on and have studied both of those issues in subsequent studies. My friend and colleague Jane Schwebke, soon after her arrival in Birmingham, set out to look at the return to treatment and return for therapy of patients who we saw in the Jefferson County Department of Health. And lo and behold, our proportion of patients who went untreated after 30 days was quite similar to that in Baltimore. 18% of cases of women who had gonorrhea, 20% of women who had positive tests for chlamydia were not treated within 30 days of being tested. In addition, in a series of studies, and Laura Bachman replicated similar observations in a similar proportion of untreated patients at the UAB, that is the hospital emergency room. And in each of these studies, we've also demonstrated a not inconsequential number of incident cases of PID in that short interval between being tested for STDs and being treated. And so I would submit to all of you out there and remind myself as well that this really represents low-hanging fruit. These are not people who need to be tested. You already know they're infected. And every time we've looked at it, there were a substantial number of individuals who indeed went untreated for periods beyond 30 days. And if one out of 25 women who are getting treated develop PID in the interval between having their tests obtained and coming back for treatment, that is a real problem. And those are metrics that we can all use in our STD clinics and our STD programs. It wouldn't take a whole lot more money to count and measure those outcomes, but ascertaining them and using them as a quality improvement metric, I think, will allow us to do better by the patients that we're supposed to be serving. So once again, I would suggest to you that the issues of diagnosis are not sufficient. Cases diagnosed is not a sufficient metric. We need to be thinking about the number of cases we treat and how long it takes us to do it. Having said that, I also want to reflect on something that I don't pretend to have a lot of answers to, and that is the issue of stigma and health disparities. And that's not a new topic at all. When Perrin wrote Shadow on the Land, he summarized his objectives with a 5-point program for syphilis control. And that 5-point program has become the model that we have basically applied with a certain amount of modification for virtually every STD that we've encountered since then. He started with case finding, that's screening, prompt therapy, still a laudable goal. Partner notification, testing, and preventative treatment where appropriate. He suggested mandatory serologic evaluations for premarital individuals and early pregnancy, and we still employ that for early pregnancy. And certainly our new efforts towards pushing HIV testing forward, the opt-out rather than the opt-in testing strategy, represents the same sort of thinking that Perrin was engaging in over 70 years ago. But the thing that troubles me is that on basically every list, whether it's the 1936 strategy for syphilis elimination or our 1999 strategy for syphilis elimination, is that the last thing on the list is always public education, symptoms. I don't know what that is. The issue of public education, public engagement, community involvement. And somehow on every list of strategies, this is always there and it's always last. And I don't know if it's last because it's something that we think we can do easily or because it's something that's just too complex to do. But in thinking about it, I have to admit, I was a little surprised to see that indeed it was always last. So let's talk a little bit more about the issues of health disparities and then a little bit more about stigma and how we approach it, knowingly or unknowingly. There was recently a really wonderful paper coming out of the Ad Health data. The Ad Health study is a series of surveys that have been done most recently with biological markers, looking at a representative survey of young Americans who were in school at the time the study was started. And the most recent survey surveyed Americans aged a representative survey and follow-up of Americans in 2001-2002. They studied over 8,000 individuals, over 2,000 African Americans, and this was felt to be a rather representative survey of Americans who were in school at this time. They used biological markers in this particular study, and as you can see from this slide, for every STD, the rates of STD in African Americans and blacks was far higher than it was in whites. Well, that's a no-brainer. We all know that. We've all heard that before. There are no surprises there. But what these authors, including Bill Levine, Bill Miller, who I think may be in the audience, did was they went on then and they stratified individuals and they created a group of individuals who they sort of aggregated by risk behaviors. And they took these individuals and they started with some of the lowest risk groups, which they called normative risk groups. For instance, young people with few partners but who were often sexually active had low levels of alcohol or other drug use. And they looked at, after correcting for issues like gender, marital status, educational attainment, functional poverty, age of first intercourse, they went on to look in both unadjusted and adjusted evaluations at the prevalence odd ratios for blacks over whites. And when you even look at these relatively lower risk group individuals, African Americans wound up with prevalence odds ratios far exceeding those of whites. Coming out of this and coming at this just sort of reinforced observations that were made at CDC's Health Disparities Conference last summer regarding the fact that trying to target individuals, targeting, particularly for minority populations in this country, is probably a waste of time. The odds of a very low-risk African-American young person who starts to have sex with a new partner in the United States of getting an STD are far higher than the odds of their white counterpart with the same set of risk factors and associated problems. And the question then becomes, what do you do with that? And how do you approach that from a policy perspective? It really says that, you know, targeting, which I think is perhaps, you know, when I think of targeting, I think of people having a bullseye on their back or their chest. And I don't think that's necessarily a useful or appropriate approach for dealing with issues of STDs in minority populations. It's something that we have to be attendant to, and it's something we have to invest in correcting. A little bit more on that perhaps later. The second study I want to mention to you was a study that I saw last year in JAMA, and it was interesting. What these investigators did is they compared 11 different healthcare quality measures amongst HMOs, and they compared commercial only, that is private insurance HMOs, to mixed private public HMOs and Medicaid only HMOs. And as their metrics, they looked at compliance with the HEDIS guidelines, that is part of our report card for assessing the quality of care. They looked at 11 different variables, childhood immunizations, cancer screening, chlamydia screening, hemoglobin A1Cs, asthma, et cetera. And what they noted, as you might expect, is that in terms of attainment of these quality indicators, almost uniformly, the rates of attainment were higher in the commercial-only HMOs than they were in the Medicaid-only HMOs. The only exception to that was chlamydia screening. And the chlamydia screening and in compliance with the HEDIS guideline has really not been so great anywhere in our country. But if you look at these data, in private insured HMOs, about 24% of women were having annual tests for chlamydia trachomatis. If you look at the Medicaid-only group, you find the only group where the rates of compliance and assessment of these quality measures was highest, and it was indeed almost 20% higher. What does that tell us about the judgment of clinicians regarding the people they care for and take care for in terms of their testing and expectations with regard to STDs? I think what it does is it informs an ongoing cycle, either understood or not understood of stigmatization regarding the sex and STDs and intolerance. No, I don't mean sex. I mean STDs. Because, in fact, I think one of the things that happens is that in our nation, we don't have any trouble talking about sex, whether that happens to be the governor of New York, whether that's on TV, whether that's in any magazine, movie, or any entertainment. What we have problems talking about is sexually transmitted diseases. So in the last couple minutes here, I'd like to share with you a wish list. And what do I mean by a wish list? Well, these are, you know, every once in a while when I'm musing or just sitting there, well, whatever, I'd say, if I were Kevin Fenton or John Douglas, what would I want to accomplish? What would I want to do? What would be a good thing to move us forward in terms of STD control? And so I have five suggestions. First of all, I think we've got to get disease out of the picture. I think we need to change the issue of health. As long as we focus on disease, we're asking for trouble. We're inviting stigmatization. And that's not a winner. We've proved that again and again and again in our efforts to control STDs. So, as a step in doing that, maybe we should celebrate the diagnosis of curable STDs, not as cases, but as cures. And tell our patients how glad we are that we've prevented them from the opportunity to reduce their risk of transmitting their infections to others and reduce their risk of complications. Thirdly, and this has been mentioned several times already, sexual health is a human right. Reproductive health is a human right. And to address those issues, I think what we really need to be doing, again, is be focusing on health and health outcomes, not on disease outcomes. And then lastly, reflecting our continuing legacy of health disparities, intended or otherwise, we need to sort of rebalance our expenditures, both public and private, in order to address the needs of existing existing disparities and to adopt some of the sorts of things that Frank Gilliam talked about in his plenary session today, the issues of investing and trying to build that infrastructure of opportunity, which is really part and parcel of changing the direction that we're going, and perhaps moving the U.S. from the country that spends more per capita on healthcare than any other nation on earth, but gets less out of it in terms of STD control, to a country in which we really have meaningful and good STD control. So I think that's my last comment. Well, this is a different sort of approach to it, but I think it's the same sort of summary, and I do think it reflects the fact that one size doesn't always fit all, and I don't pretend to think that I have all the answers or that my comments today are helpful, but I hope that I can join those of who have preceded me on this podium and many of you in the audience in beginning to move forward and changing the dialogue about how we deal with STDs. So with that, I'd like to again thank you again for the opportunity to share my thoughts, and thank you for the receipt of the Thomas Perrin Award. It truly is the highlight of my career.